This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Lynn Mark, and today I'm speaking with Professor Corinne Le Carré, Professor of Climate Change Science at the University of East Anglia. Professor Le Carré is also former director of the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research in the UK. Thank you very much for joining us this morning, Professor.
Good morning.
So one of the aspects of this COVID-19 crisis that is increasingly spoken about is the impact that it has had on the environment. There are some estimates that say by the end of 2020, we could see between a 4 to 8% contraction in CO2 emissions as a result of the government-forced restrictions that have come into place. Now, this is something you've done research into. Perhaps you could talk us through your findings.
Yes, we have indeed looked at how the carbon emissions were impacted by the confinement in particular. So we have found ourselves, we looked on a day-to-day basis as much as we could, and we have found ourselves that the countries that were in actual lockdown had very big changes in emissions of the order of 30%. But globally, because countries were not locked down at the same time, the time when the emissions dropped the most, they dropped by 17%. And that was early April when you had, large parts of the US, Europe, Russia, Japan, Malaysia also was in full lockdown at the time. So 17% is actually a very big drop in daily emissions.
How does it compare to previous drops that we've seen? Perhaps just to give us a little bit of context.
We haven't actually seen, as far as we can tell, a drop that was so big in daily emissions that is compared to a mean day in the previous year. You have to go back to year 2006 to see emissions were that low, which in fact, the emission level were that low, but the decrease in emissions is never seen before.
So as part of your study, you went through several potential recovery scenarios. So out of all of these recovery scenarios that you went through, what was the most optimistic for a reduction in CO2 emissions for the entirety of the year?
We did look at several recovery scenarios. So if we had early April, 17% decrease in emissions, how is it going to plan out for the whole year 2020? So we look at three scenarios. So the most optimistic scenario was that by the middle of June, all the recovery, so all the lockdown would be finished and everywhere around the world will have recovered to pre-COVID levels. So this is a very optimistic scenario, in fact. And with this scenario, the emissions throughout 2020 would be decreased by 4%. And at the other hand, we looked at a much less optimistic scenario where some lockdown measures would be kept in place throughout the world until the end of the year. And there we get a 7% decrease in emissions by the end of the year. And such drop in emissions are really, really big. So we haven't seen this since the Second World War. You have to go back in time. So we're talking about an annual decrease in emission of that size. And to give you an idea, the 2008-2009 global financial crisis, which we had very recently, had a decrease in emission of 1.5%. So we're talking at least a three times bigger decrease in emissions for 1 year only.
And so you mentioned the 2008 global financial crisis, and we have also seen other crises that saw drops in global emissions levels. So how did the 2008 financial crisis, which saw a 1.5% drop in emissions, compare to, say, the oil crises of the 70s and the 80s?
In terms of drop, they were all relatively the same, between 0 and 1-2% drop in emissions. I mean, what was remarkable in the 2008-2009 crisis is actually what happened after, is government put a lot of incentives in place to restart the economy. And whereas we had a drop in emission in 2009, then we had a massive rebound in 2010 of more than 5% growth in CO2 emissions, meaning that at the end of the 2010, we were exactly at the same level in terms of emission as if there would have been no crisis at all. So the economic incentive actually completely erased everything that happened in the emissions in 2009. Previous oil and gas crisis, some of the oil crisis, in fact, led to quite substantial changes in the energy was produced, in particular with the diffusion of a use of nuclear power, in particular in the 70s and 80s, which did change more structurally the progression of the emissions in time.
So can we expect that same recovery in global CO2 emissions even once this COVID-19 pandemic passes?
One thing to say perhaps very clearly is that this drop of daily emissions we see now, although it's really big, it's not a desirable drop. Of course, this is a brutal way to make emissions go down. This is not the way to tackle climate change. And it's also not durable because it is not a structural it's not a decrease in emissions, it's accompanied by structural changes. So we have the same cars, the same roads, the same buildings, the same way we use energy, the same industry. So nothing has changed around us. So as soon as the lockdown eases, then the emissions will start going up again. So what is going to matter? What matters in this crisis is really the way that governments put in place their economic incentives to restart the economy at the end of the crisis. This is really what will make a change for carbon emissions and climate change in the long term.
So as governments take this step to try and reboot the economies around the world, what kind of structural change do you see them as having the opportunity to put in place in order to drive a drop in global CO2 emissions?
There are multiple opportunities, but perhaps the one that is the most obvious is opportunities in transport, in road transport, because what has made the emissions go down during the lockdown was particularly driven by changes in road transport. So this accounted for the largest part of the decrease. And therefore, the way people are going to go back to work is going to make a big difference in emissions in the long term. So there are opportunities for governments to step in. And for example, active transport, so cycling and walking, would be particularly beneficial, but that comes with confidence from people that they will have safe roads to cycle in, that they will have parking place for their bicycles, maybe support for getting back on the bike if you haven't done it or done it ever or done it recently, maybe support by electric bicycles so you can open up commuting from suburbs, for example. It also comes with possibly encouraging home working for those who can and wish to because it reduces the need for transport. There's always going to be or in the foreseeable future a role for the car and therefore for a government to step in and electrify mobility as quickly as possible. And that means having conditions on the bailout of the automobile industries. It means broader investment to support supply chain, to support charging points, to support skills for workers. So there's a whole package that governments need to do to really make mobility transform itself from this very polluting mobility system we have now that is driven by mostly cars towards something that is much more active, that has much more electric embedded in it, and that has cleaner air.
I'm speaking with Corinne Le Carré, Professor of Climate Change Science at the University of East Anglia. Up next, striking the balance between addressing climate change and business interest. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill, where I have with me on the line Corinne Le Carré, Professor of Climate Change Science at the University of East Anglia. Professor Le Carré was also appointed Commander of the Order of the British Empire in the 2019 Birthday Honours for Services to Climate Change Science. Now, Professor, earlier we were talking about potential recovery scenarios for global CO2 emissions. Now let's delve a little bit deeper into the structural change that will need to happen in order for us to really sustain this reduction in CO2 emissions going forward. You mentioned conditions on the bailout of auto industries, and that's quite interesting. Perhaps you could go into a little bit more detail. What kind of conditions exactly do you mean?
Yes, so because we're getting out of a crisis here, you have to really protect your labor, your employees, and make sure that your economy doesn't collapse. And if you have an automobile industry that is producing petrol cars and diesel cars, which we don't need tomorrow, what governments need to do is put conditions so that these companies put in place a plan. They turn over their production entirely, and this cannot be done instantly, so it needs to come with a plan. But a plan can be put in place that includes training of the labor, that includes a supply chain, for example, the materials for batteries, where the batteries are produced, how they are recycled in the end, that includes all the elements that you need to do to transfer your production of polluting vehicles into a production of vehicles that is much more based on electric. I mentioned electric now because it's the biggest market for tomorrow, but there is also a niche market for hydrogen powered fuels.
But at the same time, I mean, particularly the auto industry, if we take an example, is a very large business, which can be very lucrative for a country. A criticism of a lot of governments thus far in the push towards addressing the climate crisis is that it has lacked the political will, sometimes in the face of pressures from the business community. So how do we address that aspect of things?
It's really quite difficult to deal with this situation where so much of the economic market is now producing infrastructure that we won't need tomorrow. So this has to be really clearly said and put in place by governments that we need to move out of petrol and diesel cars as soon as possible. And if the governments can say this clearly, if the people can claim and say that they support the change and the need to tackle climate change, then companies do not have the choice and have to make the investments at the right place to move as quickly as possible to the production of tomorrow. I mean, this has to be really something that is led ultimately from international commitments to tackle climate change through the Paris agreements, all the way to countries setting their own objectives for reaching net zero carbon emissions as quickly as possible, to putting an implementation plan in place. And unless the country leaders understand this, that it's really, unfortunately, tackling climate change is not just about investing in renewable energy and investing in green technology. It's about removing those technologies, such as petrol and diesel cars, that emit carbon dioxide. And this is a tough call, but it has to be made. And the quicker the industry can understand that and make their investments at the right place and remove their production of petrol and diesel cars, the quicker we can make this transition with really incredible benefits on air quality and quality of life in urban areas.
Mm. Still on the subject of political will, though, I mean, Professor, you mentioned the Paris Climate Change Agreement, and that was signed in 2016. But arguably not much has changed since the signing of the PCCA. And there's been criticism over the fact that it lacks an enforcement mechanism. But, you know, now that this COVID-19 has perhaps presented a unique opportunity for governments, do you see that lack of action changing going forward?
I think... Yes, I think there was not no action. I would have liked to see more actions, but there were actions put in place. A lot of countries have established their own country objectives in law. For example, the UK, France, Sweden, New Zealand have all put net zero emissions target in law, and the European Commission is also in the process of doing this with the targeting of the date of 2050 for full greenhouse gases reaching net zero, which is really quite ambitious. And those countries, when you set the target in law, then that means that actions need to be put in place to deliver these ambitious targets. What the COVID-19 crisis is doing, like every global shocks, it is providing a set of risks. And the risks are that governments try to go too fast in putting their economic incentives in place without thinking about building the resilient economy of tomorrow that we need. But the opportunities are that if governments have this vision and do see that there is a need to rebuild differently so that we are more resilient in the future to both a health and climate crisis, then there are opportunities to make these investments at the place they are needed. So that is in renewable energy and low carbon transport and also other green investments, then it could really help push over the trends that we were struggling to put in place in the past few years. It's really so important that we recognize that the crisis that we have just had comes from our failure to see risks, to see, deal, and prepare to growing risks. In this case, we had a crisis that came from a health crisis, a health threat that we haven't recognized, that we have struggled to prepare for. But there's also a series of climate crisis, climate threat that scientists have warned about, and we still fail to recognize and act at the same level. We do need now, as we put in place this new economy, to reduce those risks by mitigating, by reducing emissions. But we also need to look at the way to adapt to climate change, to make our structure more resilient, to consider that, in fact, sea level is rising, that heat waves are getting longer, more intense. And we have to look at our housing stocks. We have to look at where we live and how we can protect ourselves better. There's a series of measures that can be put in place that involve growing the natural environment, planting trees, having more green spaces in urban environment where that is possible. There are a series of measures that involve looking at infrastructure, in particular the housing stock, so that it's both efficient in winter, but also cool in the summer, and so on. And therefore, again, these government plans have to be looked at in with the double lens of being more resilient and also reducing emissions. And in the urban environment in particular, there are lots of opportunities to do this by having better transport, better housing stock, more green places.
Will all of these measures be feasible for governments to undertake, considering that coming out of this crisis, a lot of governments will be struggling to make ends meet for the foreseeable future?
Yeah, they are feasible because a lot of the measures that I'm talking about are measures that create jobs or maintain jobs at the same time as they build the infrastructure of tomorrow. I mean, when we're talking about building a cycle path, when we're talking about improving the house stock or deploying renewable energy, these are activities that that are easy to implement. They're ready straight away. They don't take a lot of research. They have a big turnover. They employ a lot of people. So these are small projects that are what we call shovel ready. So they're ready to be expanded at the large scale. And so these are the activities that governments could focus on right now as we get out of this crisis.
So, Professor, you also wrote about some drivers that may push towards a rebound to even higher emissions levels than we would have seen if the COVID-19 crisis had not happened. Perhaps you could elaborate on what exactly are these and how should we as a public think about and frame these issues in order to try and best address the climate crisis?
If we don't pay attention, there are drivers that could lead to higher emissions than we had in the past after COVID. Just for two examples, one is the use of the individual cars. So public transport is going to be more difficult for a while now. Another place where there would be a push is perhaps in the tourism sector, particularly in restaurants, perhaps less in Malaysia, but at least in Europe and North America, where restaurant space inside will also have difficulty maintaining a social distanciation. The outside space could be used more and in winter that involves heating outside terraces, which use a lot of energy. So there is a push also more structurally towards the expansion of land and using more living further out, which one has to really manage in a way that people are safe all the time. But we also think about what is the longer term impact on the emissions that are associated with all sorts of activities.
And I guess for a final question, Professor, what would you say to those who would consider addressing climate change versus protecting business interests as a zero-sum game? Is there some compromise that can be achieved between the two?
Yes, I think so. I think you want to treat the crisis a little bit mentally in two ways. There is one is the immediate support to labor and businesses, which are really struggling right this moment. So dealing with the crisis the best you can. And this is a very, very short-term economic solution. But there is the longer term, which is the investments that will come maybe towards August, September, October, which will be meant to help the businesses in the slightly longer term. And these are the investments that have really a lot of potential, both to help tackle climate change in the long term, become more resilient and be the businesses of tomorrow. But they're also the investments that could lock us into fossil fuel for a long time, making our problems a lot worse in the future. And this is where one has to be, and government investments and businesses investments have to really think about the longer term, where we don't want to live another such crisis. And the climate threat and risks are very large, and now is a good time to manage them.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us this morning, Professor. It's been a pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Corinne Lequerre, a Professor of Climate Change Science at the University of East Anglia. This has been The Breakfast Grill. I'm Lynn Muck, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.